Good morning. This is part three of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Robert Bob Cornelius, C-O-R-N-E-L-I-U-S. Again, this is part three of this oral history interview. My name is Tom Martin. Today is the 2nd of June, 2018. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. You know, in the end of part two, we were talking about Commissioner McKay was his name, and I think the nickname you used was Mumbles.
That's correct, yes.
I looked him up online between last time we talked and this time, and Thomas H. McKay was a commissioner, and then right about, I don't know, 70, 71, 72, the commissioners were retitled and their names, they became judges.
Magistrate judges. Uh-huh.
Magistrate judges, okay. Could you recount some more about Commissioner McKay?
Right. Well, he held court in the old, what's called the South Rim District Ranger Office. I think you mentioned it at one time was park headquarters. It was across the street from the old Babbitt store and post office, and then it was across the railroad tracks, kind of from the El Tovar and the Bright Angel Lodge there. And Commissioner McKay was a pretty much a kindly sort, and he was accused of being hitting the bottle a little bit too much by some people, but I never saw him, you know, where I could say he was inebriated or anything like that, but mm-hmm. that was always a rumor, but of course sometimes rumors are bad.
Right.
But some of his rulings people disagreed with, including myself at times, because you always have the prosecutor that wants to see what he thinks, how justice should be administered, and then you have the defendant and the defense, and they look at the other way, and I guess that's the great thing about our country, you know, we have checks and balances in the courtroom, too. But Judge McKay, a couple things he did was, I remember the first summer we were in the campground, and this guy had called us over there, and there'd been a dispute over a campsite, and it was late at night, fairly late at night, and guy went up to the guy's trailer, and he knocked on the door, and you know, he said, "This, you've taken my campsite," and the guy, you know, pulled a gun out and put it in the guy's face, and so we ended up going over there and citing the fella in the trailer
mm-hmm.
for, you know, display of a firearm and basically assault, and this went before Judge McKay, and Judge McKay ruled that he was justified in pulling the firearm on the man because that was his domicile and he was allowed to protect his domicile.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, in retrospect, it was probably an okay ruling, you know, but I think everybody, because of words that were exchanged and everything else, they thought that maybe it should have gone the other way.
You know?
So
uh-huh, uh-huh.
That was an example. Another time, this was when I was at Phantom Ranch, I had a case before Judge McKay, and I went up, and what had happened is one of the workers at Phantom Ranch and a couple of Fred Harvey cowboys came down, and they all got drunk, and they saddled up some mules, and they took the mules and went over into the campground with the mules, and they lassoed this guy. They came over and there was a guy and his girlfriend, and then there was this man from Texas was there, and he'd spent time cowboying and stuff himself, and the Fred Harvey cowboys came over and said, "Well, where are all the dancing girls?" And he knew that meant there was going to be some trouble, And so he sort of intervened. He got between them and the guy and his girlfriend, and one of the guys lassoed him and drug him around the campground by a rope.
Wow.
And so this wide-eyed guy, I was sitting in the ranger station, and I hear all this pounding and screaming at the front door. I open the front door, and this young man says that these cowboys have come into the campground, you know, and they're assaulting people, and I need to get up there. So I headed up into the campground, and when I got up there, the three mules were quite obvious there, you know, so I just yelled some profanity at these guys, and they took off across the creek in their mules, and I took off after them on foot, and eventually I was able to, I knew who they were because I had a flashlight, and I saw their faces, so I knew who the perpetrators were in this case. And one of them, I remember, I was walking up toward the ranch, and I saw this guy jump down into the irrigation ditch. He got right down in the water, you know. And his name was Rusty. I came along. I said, "Hey, Rusty, what are you doing? Taking a bath, you know." And later, I found his cowboy hat. He was hatless. He'd taken his cowboy hat off to kind of disguise himself, you know, so I wouldn't be able to see his shadow or his silhouette. And he'd left his cowboy hat up by an old generator house that was above the pool house there. And I found that hat, and I took it. And the other two guys I couldn't locate. So I went back to the ranger station, and I basically told these guys, "Well, I'll see you in the morning." And so I went back to the ranger station and took the cowboy hat with me. And the next morning I went up, and I sighted the his last name was Bogus. I don't remember his first name. And he sighted him in the dining hall. And then I went and found one of the cowboys. I sighted him in the dining hall, and then the third one, this Rusty, was down at the corral where the tourists, you know, you saddle up the tourists,
uh-huh.
little place there. And so I told him, I said, "Well, where's your hat?" You know, that was first thing I asked him, "Where's your cowboy hat?" And of course, you know, poor guy, he had just white as a sheet from his eyebrows up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, says, "Where's my, do you have my hat?" And I said, "Yeah, I've got your hat." I said, "It's evidence." And he wanted that hat back. He was mad, you know. And then there were several of the dudes getting ready to get on, and they kind of took his side of the whole thing, you know. And I told them, well, you know, what had happened, and just relayed it to everybody so everybody knew it wasn't he wasn't as innocent as he was putting on. And so away they all went. When we got to court, this Rusty had left the country, and the other and one of the things that they talked about, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, was they called it dude-itis, that these wranglers would have enough of the tourists. You know, they liked the mules, they liked the riding, but not all of them liked the tourists. And so they'd get what they called dude-itis, and they would do something outrageous to get fired. And then they'd go down to southern Arizona or New Mexico or Texas. They'd work, and then at some point they might come back to the canyon, you know,
mm-hmm.
and get a job again, because it's a skill set that not everybody has, you know, saddle
right.
mules and that sort of thing. So some of them were kind of rough around the edges, so to speak. So when we got to court, Rusty wasn't there, and there were only one of the guys showed up. And so Judge McKay, that's who we were talking about to begin with,
yeah,
he he dismissed the charges because he said, well, he didn't want this one person to be, you know, have to pay the penalty for the other two. So he just dismissed the charges and it all went away. Of course, I didn't have a witness. It was just my kind of hearsay. You know, they said he'd been lassoed and tied up. When I got up to the campground, he'd managed to get free. And the original complainant, he was gone. But that's, you know, that's always a problem with court in an isolated area like the Grand Canyon. You know, it's hard to get everybody back together. But I wasn't happy with his ruling anyway. So let's
back up a little bit. Did you ever feel like you were outnumbered there at Phantom Ranch?
Absolutely.
How did you deal with that?
Well, you know, law enforcement works a lot through intimidation.
Okay.
You know, people know that if they do something bad, they might get in trouble, especially if there's a cop on the corner, you know, sitting
mm-hmm.
there in his patrol car or something.
Right.
So you use that to your advantage a little bit. I had an incident one time where I went up in the campground, and there were 17 people in the Bright Angel campground, and none of them had any clothes on. And so I decided, you know, what am I going to do, you know, with this? And so I came in the upper end of the campground, and the first guy I met, I pulled my ticket book out of my back pocket, you know, kind of with a flourish, and I wrote him a ticket. Everybody else saw that I was writing somebody a ticket, and they all put their clothes on. And of course, through the whole thing, I thought, they're liable to strip my clothes off, you know, and I'm
uh-huh.
going to, you know, make me one of them, you know. So that was how you dealt with stuff, basically. And,
that's
and
brilliant.
Really in Phantom Ranch, you really were on your own, so you had to be, you know, pretty heads up as far as dealing with violations. And I had a case up Phantom Creek one time where I hiked up way up Phantom Creek, and as you go up the lower part of the canyon there, you come to a waterfall.
Yep.
And it's about 12, 14 feet high, something like that. And there is a way to climb up and over that waterfall on the left-hand side at that time if you were pretty agile, or you could climb way up and around,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that worked also. But I climbed up and over the waterfall, and then there's a long undercut cliff on the right-hand side as you get up, right-hand side as you're going upstream. And here all along this ledge is all this camping gear. And so I found a guy there, and he even had a cat with him, a domestic cat. And then I told him, well, he had to break camp and, you know, move down to Phantom Ranch. And as I was leaving, I found a little area that had been turned into a garden, and it was all had something growing in it. I looked down, of course, it was marijuana, and I told the guy, I said, what is this here? And he says, it's peas and carrots. And I said, well, it doesn't look like peas and carrots to me. So I picked all of the plants. They were small, a few inches high.
Okay.
I picked all the plants and put them in my backpack, told him I'd see him back at Phantom Ranch in the morning or later in the day. And he did. He did. He packed everything up, and he had another guy that was with him, but he had gone out for groceries or something. I don't know. Because we did have a problem with long-term camping, and they probably still do down there.
Right.
And
well, let's cycle back to McKay here, because I digressed by asking you, you know, did you feel kind of outnumbered down there at Phantom at times?
And
so clearly you did. Well, let's kind of head back to the rim there with McKay. You mentioned a couple of events where you thought his his decisions weren't quite the way you would hope they might go.
Right, and that was what we were talking about. Sure, the lassoing, the individual, the firearms threat. Those are two I remember, and I think there were others that other Rangers were grousing about, you know, but I don't remember specifics on any of them.
You'd mentioned in part two that Commissioner McKay had a nickname, Mumbles.
Right.
And I was like, did he mumble? Did you hear him mumble? How did he get that nickname?
I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea. All I know is that's what they called him. And when someone said Mumbles did this or Mumbles did that, you knew who they were talking about, you know.
Okay. Nice. Anything else you remember about him?
No, not really.
Okay. You know what? Back up a little bit. Before we started this interview this morning, you went through a list of employees, and we were cross-checking who they did and who they knew and what was going on. And at about two-thirds of the way through that list, I sat up and thought, oh, my gosh, we should be recording this. So you've kind of agreed to run through that list again.
Sure, we'll go through the list again here.
That'd be great. So this list is a list of people that you worked with, or that you knew that were in the Ranger pool, or maintenance, or trails, in that arena. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, who's at the start of the list?
Well, there's the first was, of course, the district ranger. Vernon Rusch was his name, R-U-E-S-C-H. And he was the, just to give you an idea, one reason I knew some of these people is that our first week at the canyon as a new seasonal ranger, probably late June of 69, they had an orientation, and so it was kind of a meet and greet type of thing where you got to at least see who the district ranger was, see who the chief ranger was, chief of interp, so on and so forth. And so some of the people you got to know that way.
Okay.
And it was probably pretty early, within a day or two of my getting there. I think I got there the 15th of June. So probably the 17th, 18th, 19th of June somewhere they had this thing. And this Vernon Rusch, I remember him being introduced. And I was told that he had worked there for like 20 years. He'd been at the canyon. I don't know if that's true or not. But he'd been there a long time. And he got a transfer then to Alaska, and there was a little shuffling around of positions. The one thing I remember about him is that my first job at the canyon was the, I think I said it was Rim Patrol in an earlier conversation, but I really think I worked midnight to 8 for about a week.
Okay.
Before I got the pleasure of going on Rim Patrol.
Hmm.
And I remember in the morning, it was early, the sun was up, though, and it was before 8 o'clock, and I stepped out onto the porch of the district ranger office, and I saw this sea mist green station wagon pull in up above the ranger station, and this Vernon Rusch walks down the sidewalk and steps up onto the steps next to me, and instead of saying, you know, hi, how you doing, you know, how was your first night go, blah, 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 he said, why isn't the flag up, you know?
Wow.
Very, very gruff matter. And I said, I didn't say anything. I just said, I'll get it up right away. You know, went in, got the flag, ran it up the flagpole. So there, you know, there wasn't actually a list of jobs to do. I guess they were expecting you just to figure, well, you got the flag up, you know. but I had received very minimal information as far as what my duties were, other than if the fire phone rings, answer it and start calling this list of names.
Yeah.
That was basically it. The next person was Nick Nicholson.
So I'm going to jump in here, Bob. I'm going to ask you. You've got a list of a bunch of people. Should we run through the list and then come back and pick them up one by one, or should I ask you, is that everything you remember about Vern? How would you like to do this?
Whatever way pleases you.
I'm following your lead here. Why don't we? Maybe we should. Let's just run name by name by name through the list, and then we'll come back to Vern.
Okay, let's do that. Okay, the next person on the list is Nick Nicholson, Nicholson. He was the assistant district ranger, and this is as of June 69 or so.
Okay.
Then there was another man, Jim Vukonich, Vokonich, I believe. He was, to my recollection, the Supai ranger.
Okay.
And then he also worked in the South Rim. Next one was Jack Fields, like an area ranger. And Lester Womack, another area ranger. W-O-M-A-C-K was the way that's spelled.
All right.
Bob Scott, he was at Desert View. And
so he was Desert View Ranger?
He was either Desert View Ranger or District Ranger. I think he was listed as District Ranger.
Okay.
But
so he was probably the only ranger out there, and he had that district. Would that be right?
Could be.
Okay.
Could be, yeah.
All right. Thank you.
The district came to, like I told you earlier, on Duck on the Rock was where we stopped our patrol if you worked in the south, the South Rim district, and then that's where they came to if they were with Desert View.
Okay.
There was a Dave Strope, Strope, but I think he might have come a little later on, in the winter or something. Ken Hulick, he was Inner Canyon. He had a seasonal ranger down there with it by the name of Ron Lucas. There was Glade Ross, River Ranger, and he later was replaced by Tom Doerr.
Okay.
D-O-E-H-R. And then there were three intake rangers, Jim Cutler, Carl Duhan, D-O-U-H-A-N, Phil McComb, M-C-C-O-M-B. There was Lloyd Honer, law enforcement specialist. There was Keith Trexler. He was the chief of interpretation. And the one person I mentioned earlier was a Nikki Williams, who worked as an interpreter under Keith Trexler. There were several seasonal rangers, myself, of course, Ernie Padilla, P-A-D-I-L-L-A, John Sheik, S-H-E-E-K, and then there was someone by the name of Gary, and I can't remember his last name for some reason. And then there were chief ranger at that time was Dick McLaren, and I think he was replaced later by George Vonderlippe.
V-O-N-D-E-R-L-I-P-P-E, Vonderlippe.
Right.
Okay.
And then there was Gary Howe, H-O-W-E. He was the chief of maintenance, as I recall. And then Ed Carlson. Ed Carlson was the safety officer, and then there were some trail crew guys. Jack Watson, he was the trail crew leader. Flora Strada and Ralph Wass, W-A-S-S, were the packers. Ralph was also the park farrier. There was a Fred Carver, who had been there a long time on the trail crew. There was a fellow who I think in 69 was probably a contractor, but later became Park Service, like a bulldozer operator, Howard Lapp, L-A-P-P. There was a Charlie Horning, who was down, maintenance man down in the canyon. And Victor Watahamaji was also a maintenance man, I believe, down in the canyon. Another guy didn't mention, wasn't Park Service, USGS, named Roy Starkey.
Ah, yes.
S-T-A-R-K-E-Y. And he was down at Phantom Ranch. And there was a guy named Bob Yearout who came. He came after 69, though. So, And then the superintendents, while I was there at the Canyon, Bob Lovgren was there in 69, and then later Merle Stitt, STITT, replaced him. And, of course, there's a lot of other people, too, but we also talked a little bit about John Riffey, who was over at the, what at that time was Grand Canyon National Monument.
Right. And then
Bob Yearout. There were some other. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, it was Bob Yearout.
Yearout. He was later on. He was the. I think he came in the spring of 70.
Okay.
I'm believing on him. A couple other names: Carl Christensen, Bruce Shaw, and Max Hancock. Christensen and Hancock were kind of the managers. Ranger managers. Bruce Shaw was their chief of operations. That was a little bit late, just slightly later on, because the park underwent this organizational change, and a lot of names and positions and things changed.
You know, maybe where we should. This is a wonderful list. I got to tell you, this is a great kind of who's who in Grand Canyon 1969-1970 snapshot. It's wonderful. Maybe we should start with Roy Starkey, because he's the only guy out here that is working for USGS. He's down at Phantom Ranch running that stage operation down there. And then we could kind of pick up with Vernon.
Okay.
Does that
sure?
Would that make sense?
Yeah. Well, Roy lived in what is now the Ranger. I guess Inter Canyon Ranger Station, or Phantom Ranch Ranger Station down there. It was a large, kind of a pinkish, horrible pinkish-colored building. And one of the things about it was really big. It had a large living room, kitchen, and a couple of bedrooms that went from the living room was in the kind of the center of the building. And then to the east were some bedrooms and bathroom and stuff, as I recall. And then the other direction was what he called his lab, and there really wasn't much in there. There was, I think there were like two rooms, but when I went in there, I don't remember even seeing anything in there. It was a lot of wasted space, you know.
Okay.
But the building, one of the things that was kind of awful about the building is it's set perpendicular to the canyon. So, you know, you saw it from the south rim and everything. It wasn't built with much finesse, and it certainly was kind of a modernistic, sort of an ugly building. It didn't really fit in, as I always felt, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Roy, every day, he had two areas that he worked. One was, and this was before they mechanized the river flow, you know, have satellite stuff now that tells them the flow of the river.
Yes.
And but in those days they didn't, and it had to be done by hand or by visual look. And right above the campground, he had a little area that he kind of had sort of developed a little bit. The rocks, you know, if you threw a rock in where his gauging station was, it threw off his records or his instrument and his gauge that he had there, and he'd get all mad. So we had a no trespassing sign up at the end of the campground, you know, and to try to keep people from walking, they would walk along the edge of the cliff above his gauge, and they would kick rocks down into the creek, and of course Roy would then go crazy. So we tried to keep them from getting out, getting there. Now I guess there's a little bridge across, just from, you know, looking at YouTube and stuff, there's
mm-hmm.
a bridge across that part of the campground. And but he would go over every day and he would read that gauge there. And then the other thing he'd do in the afternoon, usually he'd stroll down to the cable across the river that was upstream of the several hours out there. He'd go out on the cable car and then send these instruments down to figure out the volume of flow, and then he'd also take sediment samples, figure out what the load was of the river, and did this every day. And he was always wore a pair of blue Levi's shorts and usually no shirt hardly, you know. And he was just baked like a biscuit, you know.
Wow.
He was really brown, and he several times, I remember when I was down there, he would call me. For example, he called me like at 4:30 in the morning one time, or 5 o'clock in the morning in the winter, and he said, "Look outside, look outside." And I dutifully opened the curtain, you know, and peeked out, and we had about 5 inches of snow at Phantom there.
Wow.
And
wow.
It was really really remarkable. I mean, there was snow everywhere in the inner gorge. I've got some amazing pictures of that.
Nice.
I've got a picture of us, Roy Starkey and the workers from Phantom Ranch. We all hiked up the Clear Creek Trail, and we sat on the bench.
Oh, wow.
up on the Clear Creek Trail, and of course everybody's sitting in 4, 5, 6 inches of snow, you know. And then we went back down. We had a big breakfast down at Phantom Ranch. It was like a celebration, you know.
Nice.
Wow, snow at the bottom of the canyon.
Yeah.
And of course by noon it was all gone, you know. So it was really an unusual event. But
yeah.
He would call me up about things, you know, and particularly if somebody was up messing with his gauge there on the Bright Angel Creek, you know.
Oh,
he
yeah.
would get all upset about that. And and then the other thing that he and I would do is the Phantom Ranch had like a it was like a revolving door up there as far as help. You know, the people would come down there all starry-eyed thinking they were going to be able to hike in the canyon and camp out and do this and do that, and all they were able to do was work, and the work was hard. They had to clean the cabins, and they had to clean the dining room, and they probably had to do prep for dinners and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they were working constantly, and they didn't get paid very much, and they didn't get any days off to speak of.
Right.
And so they had trouble keeping people, and so they would get shorthanded. And so what they would do is call Roy and myself and have us come up to the ranch and for a steak and potato dinner, we and pie,
uh-huh.
we would then do the dishes.
That's
and
a fair
Roy and
trade.
I would sit there and do the dishes and you know, after we'd had our meal and everything. So
it was
a pretty good arrangement.
I was going to say, did you guys see that as a fair trade?
Yeah, because their meals were always good. You know, the pies in particular, I remember, were good, and they were actually frozen pies. They would bring them down from. They weren't homemade. They weren't made down there at Phantom.
Huh.
But they were very high quality, and they would bring them down on the mules, I guess. And there was this cook there. His name was John Bogus, and and he would go out. At some point during the meal, he would go out into the dining hall, because in those days the only people that ate in that dining hall were the mule riders, and they would have the dinner, and the rest of the time there was no food service, you know,
mm-hmm.
other than they later they had a window where people would come up and buy stuff. But he would go out in the dining room, and we would be sitting in the back eating our meal or something, and before we did the dishes, and we'd hear this big roar of laughter, and it was always John. Someone would always ask him, "Are these pies homemade?" And his reply was, "Oh yes, they're Mother John's." You know, he's got a big laugh out of everybody, and Other than that, I don't know a lot about Roy. He had a beautiful view from his front window. I know that. You know, you had that big picture window, and you could look right up at the south rim there, Mather Point and all. And that. And I don't know how many years he stayed down there. Probably a few more years, and maybe when he retired, they automated the system. I think they put satellite down there. I talked to someone from the USGS in Flagstaff just recently. I met at a wedding, and I was asking them about that, and they said, yeah, almost everything now is, satellite, and that when they do need to do sediment studies, they just, it's a special deal. Someone will go down and do it, you know, but
yeah.
It's not regularly staffed anymore.
Right, right. I mean, that happened all across the country. Transitioning to...
Yeah, we had it happen here at Black Canyon, too.
Telemetry, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the radio telemetry. So Roy got on the cable back and forth. Did you ever ride the cable out with him and just watch him collect?
You know, I never did. I never did go out there. I know Ron Lucas did that, and he was the seasonal that was down there with Ken Hulick, but then also with myself when I went down to Phantom. And he went out there one time with him. I guess it was a lot of fun, you know, going out over the river.
Okay. All right. Anything else you remember about Roy?
No, that's about it. He was a buddy. He was an unusual character. I'll say that.
How so?
Without going into a lot of detail.
Okay. I was just going to say how so, but if that's that, that's that. But okay, moving right along here. Vernon Roche.
I mentioned about him showing up and my not having the flag up the first morning. About the only other thing I remember about him is that they had a going away party, you know, at the maintenance yard, and everybody from the park showed up, and because he'd been there for a very long time, and it was quite a transition. The next person we were going to talk about was Nick Nicholson. I know he was happy about it because he was the beneficiary of Vernon's leaving, you know.
Okay.
Bruce's leaving.
Yep.
And he became went from assistant district ranger, he became the district ranger. And Nick was, had a, you know, I, the thing I always remember about him is his haircut. He was just buzzed, right, you know, real short. And he was, people would always talk about, one of his favorite expressions was, if that happens again, you'll have just enough time to pack your bags. So he was very intimidating in his management style.
Okay.
And so I had that happen to me once later in the summer where I was out, I was on campground patrol, and I'd spent all day at the campground, and they had this little Cushman cycle out there, a three-wheeled scooter, and it had canvas sides on it, and it had an engine that was just you really needed earmuffs to operate the thing. It was just like riding a lawnmower, you know, or a chainsaw or something. It just really made a racket, so you couldn't hear anything. And when you're in this Cushman cycle. And you could turn your radio up full blast, but if you didn't put it right up next to your ear, you couldn't hear anything. Well, Nick came over to the little fee office there that they had at the entrance to the Mather campground in his patrol car. And I saw him, you know, I was up in one of the loops and I saw his car come. So I headed down the hill in my little Cushman cycle, and I got out, and big smile, and how are you doing type of thing. And he says, do you have your radio on? You know, I said, Yes, of course. And I, as I handed it to him, you know, I guess I checked to be sure or something, you know, so, and that made him mad. He thought I'd just turned it on, that I'd had the radio off, you know. And so he told me that, you know, I better have that radio on and I better answer the radio. And if I didn't, you know, I'd have enough time to pack my bags. And so, you know, it was kind of scary. But then later on in the summer, you know, I did a pretty good job in the campground, and he was very complimentary in the job that I did up at the campground. And of course, he was the person that rehired me to come back in the winter, in February, from my after I graduated college, to work at the canyon. So I can't be too hard on the guy. I do remember one night, Ken Hulick and I. Ken was working on the South Rim during the winter, and I used to go out and ride with the permanent rangers for experience and just to have something to do. And so I was actually off duty, but we were driving around, and it was snowing, and there was a lot of snow on the road. And we approached the Bright Angel Lodge, and out of the parking lot comes this sedan, and it does a 360 in the on the road there, and then keeps going on down the road. And and so Ken put the red lights on, stopped the vehicle, and who would it be but Nick Nicholson. And he's had a little bit to drink. And so they Ken went ahead and let him drive home, as I recall, but I remember getting back in the patrol car, and he said, "It's Nick, you know." I guess he kind of felt obligated to let his boss, you know, get home. Nick was kind of a confirmed bachelor, but he met somebody there in the park, and he eventually got married, and then he moved on to Bullfrog, Glen Canyon, was the district ranger there. I kind of lost track of him after that. He was a pretty intense guy, and I remember a couple of, you know, I think the first rescue I ever witnessed was with him, and he came, a woman had passed out on the Bright Angel Trail, and they had a little rescue cache in the South Rim District Ranger Office, kind of a big, long closet right off the lobby there, and they put a lot of rescue gear where you could do a hasty search or a really quick, you know, quick in and out grab. Anybody could grab the stuff. And then they had a more extensive rescue cache up at the firehouse, up in the maintenance yard. And so he comes, we're screaming up, you know, red lights going and siren, and pulls up to the front of the ranger office, runs in, and I help him, you know, get a litter and a bunch of other stuff, and they had a wheel that you attach to the bottom of the Stokes litter. And
yep.
They still do that sort of thing.
Yep.
And so we got that, down the trail we all go, you know, and I think four or five of us haul this woman out, and she was I'm thinking she was somebody who had been drinking at the lodge extensively the night before and was dehydrated from alcohol, because that's what it does to you. And she got down about halfway to Mile and a Half House and had heat exhaustion, you know. So that was first. But I just remember the sort of the intensity of everything, you know, racing and things got real exciting all of a sudden, you know, and everybody seemed to know what they were doing, you know, and I was doing a lot of watching more than than anything else, you know. So
let's back up a little bit, because I want to come back to this event with, you know, what happens when you do pull someone over and they do happen to be your boss and they are inebriated, I mean, what do you do? It's not quite in the book.
No. That's a difficult one. You know, the Park Service has a way of, in those days, had a way of punishing its employees, you know. This actually happened, the scenario you just told me. Ed Carlson was not quite my supervisor yet. He had come to me and said, Bob, would you like to work down at Phantom Ranch? And I owe Ed everything, you know. But Ed was having a lot of issues with his wife. He had 4 or 5 kids, and he accused the chief, one of the maintenance men, of trying to break up his marriage and everything. And his wife and he had a fight, and he went out to CN and decided to do a little bit of drinking. And when he came back in, he had this big old station wagon. It was like a Ford Torino or something like that. And he came in the service road, and he lost control of the vehicle going around the curve and smashed his station wagon into a pinyon pine tree. And it was just wrapped, the front of the car was just wrapped around that tree. And, you know, steam and car and everything. Jim Cutler and I went out there to investigate this accident we had heard that had happened. And we pulled over, and Cutler says, that's Carlson's car. And so we're looking all through the woods where there was nobody in the driver's seat. We're looking all through the woods. We can't find Ed anywhere. And so we go over to his house, and and there we knock on the door, and Ed casually comes to the front door and opens the door, you know, and we go in, and he sits down in his lazy boy chair, so to speak, and Cutler talks to him for a while, and Ed says, oh, no, I don't know anything about that wreck, you know. He knew nothing about it or anything. Well, Jim Cutler ended up writing him a ticket for, I don't know what the ticket was for. It could have been for leaving the scene of an accident, or it could have been he didn't do any roadside sobriety maneuvers or anything like that on Ed.
Uh-huh.
So I think they may have just assumed the drunk driving aspect of it, or put it in there just to have an extra charge. But anyway, Ed ended up going to court, paying a fine, and then it was a little uncomfortable for me initially. I thought, you know, geez, I'm this guy I'm going to be working for. I'm having to go over and have these confrontations with him, and. There was another incident too involving him. I won't go into right now.
Hey,
but,
Bob, let me stop there for a minute. I mean, it's uncomfortable for you. It must have been very uncomfortable for Jim, who wrote the citation.
Well, I'm sure it was, but you know, you got to do what you got to do. And,
right.
I always remember this guy here, actually in Montrose, that worked for the Colorado Division of Wildlife, and. He would always say, you know, I don't play with my job. I don't, that's a different, you know, I just don't play with my job. That's,
right.
And that's the way you have to approach it. You have to say, well, you know, it's, they've done the bad deed. They've got to,
right.
Got to pay the piper now.
Except
that's
that
the way
that's
what you have to do. And it is uncomfortable.
The NPS does have a way.
The Park Service would.
Yeah. Well, you'd mentioned that the NPS has a way of punishing its employees. So
what they would do, if particularly in those days, if they'd say if you want to advance, screw up, you know. But also, they would transfer people if someone embarrassed the Park Service in something that they did, or even let's say you stopped a politician or something, maybe, and somebody with a little bit of pull, they might transfer you. So you people kind of walked on eggshells a lot. They really were running scared a lot of the times because they didn't want to offend the wrong person and end up going to Tousy Gooch, or something. So it's kind of a very, very poor way to manage an organization, but that's what they were doing.
Well, it's interesting because we can take a little sidebar rest stop here for a minute and just ponder the sexual harassment on the river, which has been in the news over the last few years, which really points to a larger systemic problem of bullying, if you will,
Oh, absolutely, huh?
which you're talking about right here in 1969,
Mm-hmm.
1970. So, yeah, this has been problematic for generations of Park Service employees.
That's right.
I don't know if that's something you want to speak to now or later.
Well, sure we can. We can. One of the, you know, I was insulated from a lot of things, I think, by being at Phantom Ranch.
Ah.
I was pretty much the Lone Ranger down there. So there really a lot of stuff that was going on the South Rim, I either didn't know about or that's generally what it was.
Uh-huh.
I just didn't know about it. There were things like they used to have these baseball parties up there, and there was a wife swapping, and I think George Vonderlippi, I think he got involved in hanky panky with his secretary, and just a lot of stuff going on. I mentioned this one woman earlier when we were talking before the tape started, by the name of Nikki Williams, and she was the only really uniformed ranger in the park, and she was a seasonal interpreter, and her dad, her father was Jack Williams, who was the governor of Arizona at the time, and so she had some political pull. But I remember people talking about rangerettes and then there was the business too about the uniform. Even the uniform the women wore was kind of crazy. They tried several different types of uniforms where they looked like airline stewardesses or something. So, I mentioned the name Bob Yearout earlier, and I think Bob was brought to the canyon, and one of his jobs, he was brought there by Bob Lovegren, and one of his jobs was to try to level the playing field as far as bringing women and minorities into the Park Service, because Park Service was really getting hammered about the inequality of their workforce. So it was an all male organization, and he was sent up to the training center, and they had a whole group of intakes there, and they brought people in and vetted every one of those employees, or excuse me, yeah, employees and trainees, and with the intent really of bringing more women into the service, and men that were scheduled to go through the training session, this was in about 1970, were sent down the road, and they were replaced with a woman or a minority, and it was really hard, really hardball they were playing. One of the guys I worked with, he was a seasonal ranger that I worked with down in the canyon. He actually came down in the canyon, worked for a while, and then all of a sudden Well, then he went up to the training center, and then he was let go. And he was a, you know, a real competent guy.
Huh.
But they were playing hardball, and I guess somebody had to be the bad guy, and it ended up, you know, ended up being Bob Yearout was sending people down the road, or at least that's what what I've heard.
Well, it's interesting because it was a step, if you will, in the right direction to sort of get out of the good old boy club. And
right.
yet the bullying issue, whether it was a white male on a white male, or in the future it was a white male on a minority or a female, or it was a minority on a white male or a minority on a female, or was a female on a female or a female on a white male or a female on a minority, that bullying culture seemed to continue.
I'm not aware of it. In as far as you know, later in my career, I didn't see that.
Okay, and
I didn't participate in it. And we're not talking about Grand Canyon anymore, because of course I left Grand Canyon. But
right.
I some of the most competent, at least seasonal rangers that I hired were women, and
mm-hmm.
I think I probably had a difficulty getting over that hurdle myself initially. But I ended up hiring a gal by the name of Vicky Zarlingo, and she was really, really a hardworking gal. She had been I hired her to be a boat operator, basically, up
okay.
at Kirkcanny, and she had worked like on a salmon boat or something as a captain, you know.
Wow.
She was really a good boat operator, and she was a hardworking person. She was a school teacher, and so she was a pretty smart gal. And, you know, if I ever had any doubts about the quality of the work of a woman, she put those to rest because she did such a great job. She worked for me for about 4 years, I think, and, you know, came back every season. And I really got so I depended on her because she would help train all the new seasonals, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm not questioning competency, but it's more that structure of punishment, that sort of structure. And
yeah, I suspect it went on, you know, throughout my career at some level. I never really experienced it too much in the parks where I was.
Great, great.
I never felt like I was, you know, there was some intimidation. I had one superintendent in particular, I remember, who was very, very, very intimidating and you know, did make it difficult for everybody.
Okay.
I've, you know, and so I guess it probably was going on right up into the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, if not later. But
yeah, could
I
be
mean,
right now. Well, I've read some of the articles you're probably referring to, you know, with both the river runners and also like fire and crew trail crews and things like that, you know.
Sure.
To me it just seems you know, crazy, but I guess
right.
Some people just don't know better.
Well, to the agency's credit,
their position.
I mean, to the agency's credit, I think that they're really trying to now move forward on that. I mean, you mentioned Roy Starkey in the USGS. GS has a pretty good policy on bullying, and so I think the agency, you know, has potential here to sort that out.
Yeah.
So we live in hope. All right, so we were talking about Nick Nicholson, kind of cycling back around here. Did we, you know, is a tense kind of guy, is the flag up on the flagpole, and is your radio turned on? And yet, it seemed as though if he saw a hard worker that was trying, he recognized that.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think he was fair from that standpoint. And when I came back in the winter, as I recall, Nick had transferred, and or he was about to transfer, and then we ended up with some new leadership. Carl Christensen was in the district ranger. So,
okay. All right. So then, looking at the list, scrambling here, next after Nick would have been Jim Vukinich, the Supai Ranger.
Yeah, Jim Vukinich, as I understood, worked Supai. In those days, the campground between Havasu Falls and Mooney Falls down at Havasu was National Park Service
right.
operated, and the national park actually surrounded the Indian reservation, the Supai Indian Reservation,
mm-hmm.
And so the park was responsible for everything that went on down. And that first summer, there was a Boy Scout troop down at Supai, and they all got really sick, and they attributed it to the water down there. Now, whether they had drank Supai Creek water or whether they had drank water from the spring, they decided that they needed to check the spring. And I think they found some issues with the spring where people got water. So they put an iodinator there on the spring to be sure the water would be good, or a chlorinator. Maybe it was a chlorinator. To get back, well, Vukinich was in charge of all that sort of thing. And so he was a great big guy. We called him Big Jim. He was like 6'6 or 6'7. And, you know, he was kind of intimidating when he'd come in. And he you were talking earlier about how do you deal with situations. Well, he had a very gruff manner about him. You know, he could be very gruff. And I think some of it he just got tired of answering the same question over and over and over. You know?
Dude-itis.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the old dude-itis stuff. I remember one time Harvey Buchert came in to get a permit, you know, and in the South Rim District Ranger office there, and he came up to the desk, and I was asking him all kinds of questions. I didn't know who he was, you know, and Vukinich came out and said, "Give him his permit," you know. So, but he was another thing that I remember one night, I was dispatching. I was on this midnight to 8 shift, and there was a skunk had got hit by a car out in the intersection just to the north of the district ranger office.
Okay.
And well, we could smell it even in the office there, you know.
Yeah.
And so I waited until Vukinich was coming on duty at 11 o'clock. And so I gave the radio call, you know, "Jim, could you go by? And there's a dead skunk in the intersection, you know, near the ranger station there, you know, and would you be able to pick that, get that out of there, you know?" And I remember the radio call coming back, something like 10-4, you know. You could tell he was really PO'd at me for giving him that assignment, you know. But later in the summer, or in the fall, he, you know, they had this chlorinator and stuff on the spring at Supai. He came to me and he asked me if I'd like to go down to Supai for a week. I ended up going down there for I guess either it must have been a 10-day tour,
huh.
And that was either in the fall or it might have been in the spring. I think it was actually in the spring when I had come back from my college. And so
spring of 1970.
Yeah, I think it was spring of 70. Come to think of it,
okay.
And I went down and there was a big tent down there and that was my quarters, and then my job was to he assigned me a couple of things. One was to monitor the chlorine level in the spring. I had to, you know, make a keep a running account on that, getting the water samples, taking them up to the village and having them mailed out, and then I had to dig a relocate an outhouse down there, dig a big pit and move the outhouse over. I did that. Pick up all the trash. The trash was unbelievable down there at Supai.
Bob, I'm gonna jump in here and mention that George Billingsley had spent some time there as well as the Supai Ranger, and he had trouble with trash. So can you tell me how you dealt with that trash?
I met George Billingsley a long time ago. I remember him from the canyon. He was working with NAU or something at the time when I was doing research.
USGS, yeah.
Was that who he was with?
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, as I recall, what we were doing was taking the trash up one of the side canyons there above kind of to the other side of the falls there or something. I don't think we packed it out. I can't, I'm having a hard time remembering exactly what we did.
So what George said was that there were some mine works up Carbonate Canyon, up past the Supai Cemetery there, and he was instructed to dump the trash in the mine works.
That's probably right.
I don't know if that rings a bell with you or not.
They were looking for places to put it, I know.
Okay.
It was everywhere.
Okay. Yeah, because there was no trash removal to any kind of landfill.
Yeah, that's probably true. We might have. I was thinking at Phantom, of course, we sent it out on mules, but here
right.
We were dealing with the tribe, and they didn't want anything to do with it. So we were probably putting it in gunny sacks and taking it someplace. It's interesting that I can't remember that. Maybe. Maybe I blocked that out of my memory, because all I remember is that the trash was terrible down there. And I don't remember having a burner, but we may have had a burner down there that we were burning it. But I just don't remember.
Yeah, and I think Billingsley had said that they were putting it in this mine shaft, and he came in after you. I think he was between 70 and 75 when he was in there. So that would have been happening. I did want to swing off on another tangent here for a minute and talk about trash at Phantom, because in the 1950s, the Phantom Ranch trash was just dumped in the river.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, that changed. And so by the time you got there in 69, 70, the trash was going on the mules and up the trail.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Okay, so that narrows that down a little bit to figure out that change would have been implemented already before you, just to make a note of that. Thank you.
Right.
Okay, so Jim sends you out to Supai for a week. Now, you have been to Supai already as a California Sierra clubbing David Brower hanging out with kind of kid, and here you are in Supai now working for the Park Service. Did you see that area, Supai, differently as a Park Service employee than you had as a private citizen?
Well, sure. Now you've got responsibility. When you visit a place, you don't have any responsibility. If you don't want to pick the can up, you don't have to. Or the cigarette butt or whatever.
Yeah.
But as an employee, you have responsibilities. So the trash and cleaning the restrooms and
mm-hmm.
Putting the teepee in the restrooms and keeping people from tearing vegetation up and trying to so that you have a campfire, busting up fire pits, just all these different things that you had to do. It was a job now. It wasn't something that was, all pleasure.
Right.
And trying to figure out ways of getting people to comply. One of the things I noticed about Supai was that people did not recognize that they were in the national park there.
Oh, interesting.
They really didn't know where they were, I don't think. They were down there, you know, probably thought they were on the Indian reservation. Most of them were down there just to have fun, and some of them were down there and didn't care whether they, you know, took the trash out or not. And
that's yeah.
Just, you know, that's pretty common
with yeah.
all of
yeah.
us, I guess.
One of the other things that Billingsley mentioned was that the wind would cause havoc with the cottonwood trees and drop big branches down on the ground at inopportune times.
Oh, yeah. And they had a Boy Scout or a kid killed down there when I was at the canyon. A branch fell out of a tree and right on the sleeping bag, you know, and killed this kid.
Aye.
And so there were... those were always issues in Grand Canyon campgrounds. We had the same concerns at Phantom Ranch. They had a Western tree crew group that would come in and tried to trim up all the trees and stuff, the bigger ones, to keep them at least more safe. But we knew that. These Fremont cottonwoods, you know, they get rotten inside,
yeah,
inside the branches, and you can't tell from the exterior if the limbs are weak or not. And then when the wind comes, they self prune, and if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you're in trouble. And I used to go up into the campground at Phantom in particular, and if it was real windy there, and I would tell people not to camp underneath the cottonwood trees, you know,
nice.
get out in the open there.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the situation is down there now as far as number of trees, but, you know, we only had a few really, really big trees when I was there.
Okay.
Most of the trees were plantings that were still growing in the upper part of the campground, and there were a couple of big trees down in the lower part of the campground.
Okay, so that was a 10-day detail that Jim had sent you out to.
Right. Uh-huh.
What else do you remember about Jim?
At Grand Canyon, they may still have the same system. They had a system of trying to be as equitable as they could with housing. And so they had a point system, and you got points for what your grade was. You got points for how many children you had. You got points, I think, actually, for how long you'd worked. And I remember Jim grousing and carrying on because Fred Carter, who was with the trail crew, I can remember Jim saying, that guy's got... you know, got 100 kids, you know. So, he was upset because he had lost out on a Mission 66 house, and he was in one of the older Park Service houses. Jim went on, after he left the canyon, he became, I think it was superintendent at Capulin Mountain, which is near Raton Pass in New Mexico. And then later... he went on to, I'm not quite sure what his position was, but he was at Bandelier National Monument. And I actually went and visited him.
Oh, wow.
At Bandelier, had dinner, you know, with him. And remember, he told us about a bunch of extra cool places to go, you know, that people didn't know about in the area and stuff
right.
like that.
Right.
After that, I kind of lost track of him, and don't remember much else. So.
Okay. Well, all right. So that's Vern Roosh and Nick Nicholson, and Jim.
Jim.
Is now a good time to say we'll wrap it up with part three, and we'll pick this up again with Jack Fields in part four.
We can do that. That would work for me.
Okay. Let's do that. I'll wrap this up. Please hold the line, and then we'll do some scheduling.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. So this is the end of Part 3, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Bob Cornelius. Today is the 2nd of June, 2018. My name is Tom Martin, and thank you so much.
You're welcome.